Radio Decidim. The following conversation took place in November 2020 at Decidim Fest.
Hello everyone and welcome to this dialogue on sustainability and scalability of free software projects. My name is Carol Romero. I'm part of the product team at Decidim, and I'll be hosting this conversation with three great guests where we are going to talk about an old classic in the open source universe. I believe that in almost any tech conference, there is always a session or even a whole track on how can we scale and maintain FLOSS projects. And the truth is that after more than three decades, this still remains a challenge for most open source initiatives and their communities. And here at the Decidim, being still a quite young project with only 4 years in the making, we have started to ask ourselves some questions on this subject, and we thought that this conference, the Decidim Fest, was the perfect time to connect and talk to people from other projects who have more experience on dealing with these issues. So we're going to start with two short talks from the projects that we have invited. They are the Foundation for Public Code and the Jitsi video conference platform. And after that, we'll have a discussion with our speakers on some of the challenges that we see at Decidim when we think, for example, about scaling up our community or becoming sustainable in the long run. Of course, we'll also have some room for your questions. So if you're just tuning in and you want to participate, you can do it using the link in this below this video in the description, or if you're already watching us from Meta Decidim, just submit your questions through the comments section. All right, let's go with our first speaker. Her name is Alba Roza from the Foundation for Public Code. She's a developer relations professional who has been working in tech communication and marketing since 2011. And in the last 6 years, Alba has specialized in supporting software communities. And at the foundation, she now works as a code-based steward. Welcome, Alba. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you, Carol. Likewise, I'm super happy to be here and, you know, surrounded by this group of professionals. Super happy to have this conversation today.
So I presented you, Alba, as a code-based steward, and I think it would be great to start by knowing what code-based stewardship means and what is the personal work that you do at the foundation. And yeah, also, just in order to open a little bit the today's topic, I ask you, what does sustainability mean to you when it comes to open source projects?
That's it. So can I hijack the screen?
Okay. I think so.
Let's do it then. Yeah. Okay. I think you're seeing everything I'm seeing. Let's start with it. Yeah, so I've put together these slides to talk about sustainability and also scalability in code bases that we usually work with in the Foundation for Public Code. But before starting to talk about this, I would like to talk about what public code means, right? So for us, public code is when the software implements policy that is both produced by and for the public. So that's what we call public code. And in the Foundation for Public Code, since I'm assuming most of the audience that is today out there is very familiar with open source projects and open source communities, in the foundation, we basically support public organizations by stewarding open source code bases. That's it in a nutshell. And related to my job, my role, I'm a code-based steward, as you said. And this means basically that my specialty areas are both building communities and also product marketing. And I'm here today to talk about, yeah, what we've learned so far from the stewardship team in both sustainability and scalability. So in order to give this a little bit of structure, I'm going to say that I've put together 8 specific risks for public sector code bases, and I'm going to briefly go over them. And besides that, I've also I'm also going to briefly talk about best practices for strengthened communities in general. So let's start without further ado with the specific risks for public sector code bases. So the first one I would like to stop in is, of course, economic risk, right? Everything related to the changes to budget. This is a special risk for public code. If public organizations are not budgeting appropriately for maintenance or further development of an existing code base. Another one would be a political one. So let's think, for instance, of a change of government. And let's think that it can happen that incoming governments, they are often tempted to cancel work by the previous administration. So if we expand the community through to have a bunch of geographic areas, that's how we're going to ensure, and that's how we're going to get a truly internationally sustainable code base. Policy changes, of course, that this could be, for example, due to a change in risk appetite, a procurement policy that changes, or even a industrial policy, right? This is why we need a clear governance structure in this code basis, and we also need to build deep understanding and support for using open source within a public organization. The fourth, if I'm not mistaken, risk that we may encounter is over-reliance on one vendor. Let's say that there's a big risk that a public sector market isn't big enough to justify vendors joining a code-based community. Let's think that there aren't enough potential customers for the vendor to build a business model around that code base. The risk for this code base then is over-reliance on one vendor, right? So building public code bases to scale internationally from the start increases the size of the potential market. And we are also in contact with a community in the Foundation for Public Code that even before starting developing the project, they keep this in mind. And they study if it's going to be feasible or not, depending on the ecosystem that this code base is going to have in the future. A following risk would be also the bus factor, a very known one, a problem in case someone gets hit by a bus. It's a common one in the open source communities. And this would be over-reliance on too few people, right? If that happens. So documentation and also purposefully inviting people in to participate more deeply in the community would allow us to, mentor to build the following generation of leaders in that community. And engineering guidelines, of course, we have to keep them in mind. And when I say engineering guidelines, I mean, for instance, if you plan to scale, we from the Foundation for Public Code prefer set-based APIs instead of of individual item or even individual object APIs. This will allow the code base to handle larger amounts of throughput as it increases in popularity, right? So this is basically a design choice we encourage you to make on early on based on your ambitions. Let's put an example here. For instance, if you want to optimize calls to a database, right? If you know that it's going to be a recurrent thing that is going to happen in your project or in your code base over and over again, well, maybe it's more intelligent if you start thinking beforehand how to deal with that problem in order to make it more efficient for the code base. And what do I mean by code bases working practices that can scale? Well, we believe that it might be more efficient for some purposes to work with smaller teams. For instance, a decision making. We, in the Foundation for Public Code, we are trying to implement it in the code base we steward throughout the thing we call the steering groups. And right now we're using, for instance, we have the technical steering group. We have the product steering group, also communication steering group. And in these meetings, joining is optional, by the way, by the rest of the community. And yeah, this is a simpler way and faster way of making decisions, right? And this is the last one, and I'm about to finish, I promise. This is the eighth risk that we detect, and it's, of course, the lack of knowledge of the public sector, right? You have to understand the system you're working in order to survive it. That's clear. And after these eight risks that we usually detect from the code base team, there are also some other. Well, I would like, first of all, to stop by something that we personally feel very proud of, and it's this. This success story from the OpenStack market consultation. OpenStack is a code base that we've been working with for several months, let's say. And if you go to our blog, blog.publiccode.net, there's an entry that is a post written by our colleague Felix, and he explains in there the lessons learned for how to build a public organization or vendor community from scratch. So if you're actually looking for more concrete tips or more specific tips to avoid these risks or to prevent these risks or challenges when growing, I strongly recommend visiting this article written by Felix. And yeah, to wrap it up, I've been going through like more specific public code communities guidelines, but of course, these communities, they belong to the world of communities, right? There are several communities, a lot of communities out there, not 100%, not all of them, of course, involved with public code. So there are like some obvious things that you would recommend for thriving your a community that, I don't know, would be, for instance, building authentic relationships with the rest of the members. So, and also by building authentic relationships and providing people with a value or sentimental value, or, you know, this joint feeling of doing stuff all together. That would also, for instance, detect and prevent burnout, which is something that it's super common in open source communities. I don't know, you can also use the reward ambassador program. So by doing that, you would put the community in the spotlight. I would recommend, I don't know, providing value at the beginning, a lot of value, a lot of documents, a lot of work, instead of, you know, looking for maybe protagonism that some members might look from the beginning, I don't know. And also learning, being very humble and learning also from other communities, right? So, I don't know, not only participating in their communities, but also be part of other communities. That's also super helpful. And also very specific for public code or public environment communities, I would strongly recommend to keep in mind that things go slower than in other sectors or other industries. So keep in mind this small pace and not try to overstep. And I don't know, as a last one, I would also say, for instance, that it's interesting if you provide the community with the journey, with your pipeline beforehand, so they know what to expect and what to look up to, right? I don't know, these are a bunch of tips. And other tips that maybe you can use for your community? Well, so these are several reports that that came to my mind related to this topic we've been talking about. So for instance, New America, they have a report named Building and Reusing Open Source Tools Governments. And I would strongly recommend that if you're a manager, for instance, to get to know what things can you expect and avoid. And for instance, OSER, they also have this guideline for creating sustainable open source communities that I would recommend more maybe to policy tech people. And of course, this is like a personal, very personal one. I've came across with Mark Head's guide. He has a guide called How to Talk to Civic Hackers, sorry. And I found it very, very insightful. So I would also recommend that for everyone, more general civil servants, maybe. And of course, I can't finish this talk without recommending the jewel of the crown of our very own Foundation for Public Code. And this is the Standard for Public Code. You have the link down there. So you can access standard.publiccode.net. Standard for Public Code is how we ensure sustainability in code bases from the Foundation for Public Code. This is basically a set of certification criterion. Sorry, there are 15 right now. And we use it to audit other code bases and contributions. And and it's of course collaboratively defined and continuously versioned. We've created this, we've put up this standard with the help or the support of the rest of the community. But yeah, if you go through the criterion, you'll find some recommendations to avoid these risks and challenges to walk through towards sustainability. Like for instance, I don't know, use plain English or I don't know, welcome contributors, right? Like how to do that. And yeah, that's all. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Alba. I think that you perfectly highlighted almost every risk that any open source project faces in terms of sustainability. And thank you also for the great tips that you gave us. I hope we can have some time in the Q&A session to comment on that. But now it's turn for our friends of the GT project. We have with us Jeya Alamsetti. She is a senior software engineer on the JIT team with a decade of experience developing video conference software. Welcome, Jeya, and good morning to you.
Thanks, Carol. Hello, everyone.
And a special thanks because I know it's quite early right now in the States. I hope you at least had time to grab some coffee or something. And with Jeya is also Saul Ibarra. Saul works on Jitsi at 8x8 and it's the self-appointed chief Jitsi evangelist. Welcome, Saul.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having us. Really a pleasure to be here.
And let me tell you, Saul, that as an evangelist, I'm afraid you're preaching to the choir here because, as you can see, we're using Jitsi to run our conference. We were already big fans of the project before the pandemic came in. But of course, since then, Jitsi has become a critical infrastructure, not only for us, but for many people around the world. So I believe you're going to tell us more about what is Jitsi, what do you do there, but it would be really awesome also to hear that story about how did you go from having a few hundreds of thousands monthly active users to a few million in less than a year.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to hear that you were using it before. I use that title to start with a joke that always works. And today, Jeya is going to tell you all about how we scaled up, and then hopefully we'll do some interesting questions.
Yeah, I'm so pretty excited. So let me start my slides here. And yeah, let me turn on my camera now. Yeah. I guess you're all able to see me. So, yeah. So, thanks everyone, and thanks Carol for having us here. So, my name is Jeya Alamsetti, I am a Jitsi developer, and I joined Jitsi just over a year ago. And here I am today talking about what Jitsi is, how it's used, and what kind of challenges we faced in scaling our service to meet the surge in demand due to the pandemic, in the last few months. So, So Jitsi is a set of open source projects that allows you to easily build and deploy feature-rich and secure video conferencing solutions. Like, it runs in the browser and you don't need any downloads. And it's based on WebRTC, which is an open framework that enables real-time communication capabilities in the browser. So currently, like, there are three ways in which people use Jitsi, like the meet.jit.si or 8x8 VC service that we provide for free. Like, this conference right now is hosted on 8x8 VC. And then people can actually use their own or someone else's self-hosted instance. Like, we make it really easy to build and deploy your own instance. Like, there is a ton of information out there on how to do it. And we have a very helpful community of users who can guide you. And you can even find a YouTube tutorial about installing Jitsi on a Raspberry Pi. So it's like, it's how simple it is. And then, like, we have a third option for those who want to be able to quickly embed video conferencing into their applications, but do not want the burden of maintaining their own infrastructure. So for them, we offer Jitsi as a service, as an alternative, where we take the responsibility of maintaining the infrastructure for them. And let's move on to, like, we want to talk about what happened in the spring, right? Like, the spring deluge. So, like, at the onset of the pandemic, like, as more and more countries were going into lockdown, we started to see a surge in the traffic. Like, we started seeing double the traffic we were seeing the day before. And this was happening every single day, and it lasted for weeks. So not only this was, like, unprecedented for us, but it's also usually really hard, like, to deal with such a sustained change in usage without a massive re-engineering effort. So if you want to talk numbers, like, you have the numbers here. Like, we had 60 times more conferences, 300 times more participants, and 180 times more traffic. So before the pandemic, we were, like, managing servers by the tens, and it quickly escalated to, like, the thousands at the peak. And yeah, the numbers are very crazy, but that's how it was. So, but we had something that, like, people really needed in those times, and we were fortunate enough to have the backing of 8x8 VC, and we got down to work, and it was all hands on deck, like, for weeks. So let's take a sneak peek of what our infrastructure looks like and how we handled all that traffic. So at the time, like, we ran all our infrastructure on AWS. I mean, I don't want to go into all the details about trying to explain what each and every component is, but what I wanted to highlight here is that we had a globally distributed and horizontally scalable infrastructure that was, like, spread across multiple regions in the AWS cloud. So we had this ability to stand up a region and dynamically, like, route the traffic whenever and wherever it was needed. So, like, as an example, like, in the midst of the crisis, we had to quickly deploy the Paris region to handle the surge in the traffic that we were seeing in the Central Europe to keep the latency low. So what I wanted to emphasize is that we had a solid foundation to begin with, but that doesn't mean we didn't have any issues. Like, yes, we had problems, like, many of them, and on each and every component. Though we didn't need any major re-engineering, but what we had to do was, like, mostly removing bottlenecks through configuration and making our own software more resilient under heavy load. Like, some of the problems that we ran into were, like, ephemeral port exhaustion, like, we were hitting file descriptor limits, and then some of the modules that we had in our signaling server was suboptimal. So, but what happened is, like, we've had this infrastructure in place for about 5 years now. We haven't changed it a bit, but then what the pandemic has, like, I mean, what it has done is it has, like, this infrastructure has probably proved itself. Like, hats off to our developers and the DevOps team especially, and we couldn't have done it otherwise. And something that we also did during the summer break was to, like, move all our media nodes out of AWS and into the Oracle Cloud, like, as a cost optimizing measure. So for those of you who already have used AWS, you probably know that bandwidth can get really expensive over there. And not only that, like, we are multi-cloud ready now, and we could potentially leverage the other infrastructures, like, in the infrastructure providers in the future. And there was another feature that we implemented that we call offstage layer suspension. So what we do here is like we dynamically adjust the resolution of a video a user sends, depending on how that user is being viewed by other participants in the call. Like, let's say you're in a large meeting and then you're using Tile View and no one is viewing you at a resolution like greater than 180p, then why waste CPU and send HD and SD resolutions, right? So this is when layer suspension kicks in and we stop sending SD and HD resolutions, and this saves CPU and bandwidth on the clients and thereby improving performance. And then that also reduces the processing power that's needed on per participant basis on the bridges that are in our infrastructure. So that was about load, but let's talk about usability. Like, while we were trying to keep our service afloat, we had a ton of all these first-time users who were like trying to use in ways that we didn't envision, and some of the features that were features were not being discovered because they were not obvious to them. And so we did have like usability, and we also had to make our client ubiquitous so that it could run everywhere. Like, we did an overhaul of our Firefox support for all the privacy-minded users because it was a big deal for them. And we also added support for like Safari and mobile browsers. And based on all the feedback that we received from the Jitsi community, like through the numerous channels, like we developed and launched many small and big features that improved the usability of our product. So let's take a look at what those changes are. So this is an easy one, easy win. Like, we had all these first-time users who were probably used to all these messaging services that had some kind of a contact list. And they were confused as to how you could invite other people into the meetings, like when they were using Jitsi. So this is something that you don't think of when you're using your product every day, but yeah, we got the feedback loud and clear that it was not obvious. So we made it easier and more obvious to share the meeting information. We have this button here, you click on it, and then yeah, you see all the different options for sharing this information. You see all the different channels that you could use for sharing the meeting information with other people in the conference. And then there's another feature. I mean, we added a new pre-join screen where you can actually choose your devices and test them before you join a meeting. Like, you don't have to be worried about like weird camera angles or like your mic not working before you land into a room full of users, right? You don't want to troubleshoot your device issues once you're there. So, and then, as our user base grew, so did the abuse. Like, we were receiving a lot of complaints, and so we worked on adding a number of measures to make sure people can have their meetings safely. So for example, this is like something very simple but highly efficient. Like, when you select a meeting name, a room for your name, we actually make it so we'll show a warning if that name is easy to guess. And this way, you know that you should probably use a password or enable the lobby and keep the bad guys out. So this was a very simple but effective feature. And speaking of which, we have this new feature called Lobby. This is like a security mechanism that we have in place to prevent uninvited users from entering the conference. Like, once you enable it, like, the moderator of the room will get a notification about users who are waiting in the lobby, and they can enter only once they're approved. So, and yeah, I think, yeah, let me, yeah, I have to pick up my pace now. So we've also actually grouped all the security options in a security dialogue to make it a one-stop shop for all things security. That's like, we have this new shield icon at the bottom of the conference. When you click on it, you have your all the options to like enable lobby or add a password for your conference or enable end-to-end encryption. And speaking of this, yeah, this is the new exciting feature that we've been working on recently. Like, we are already on our second iteration of the implementation. Like, this is an extra layer of encryption. WebRTC actually already encrypts all the streams with like TTLS SRTP, but we add another layer of encryption over that. So we use insertable streams, like, that allows developers to access, to have access to the raw audio and video frames as they come in and before they get sent out. So what we do is, like, we encrypt the frames as they go out from the browser, and then we decrypt as they come in to the receiver. So I think there's, like, yeah, there's so much to talk about, but looks like I'm a little out of time here. So I'm gonna wrap up this presentation with this picture. Like, this AR picture is worth a thousand words, and I couldn't have chosen a better one. So this was sent to us by the staff of a hospital in Italy. Like, these are the people who were, like, at the front lines battling this deadly virus, and yet they took out the time to let us know how much they appreciated us and how we were able to help them keep their patients connected with their loved ones. Like, it makes it all worth it. Like, this is what makes Jitsi so special, right? Like, it's not every day that we get the chance to have such a positive impact in the world. So I would like to wrap up on this positive note, and thanks for the time. Back to you, Carol.
Thank you so much, Jaya. It's been a wonderful presentation, and I think it's very moving that you ended with this slide. And I guess that when you see these kind of grateful responses, all of a sudden your work makes totally sense, right? Yeah. And I think it's very impressive the work that you've done in such a short period of time. So congratulations for that. We'll be discovering the exciting new features of Jitsi. So let's go with the questions that we have prepared. And I'm going to start with something related to what Jaya mentioned in her presentation. And this is about the explosion growth that you experimented in the project. And you talked about how did you need to increase the infrastructure layer to give response to the high demand. But what about the organizational layer? How do you handle when you have this exponential growth practically overnight? And I'm thinking about hiring more people, using other resources beyond the logistics of more data centers or infrastructure. What do you think on that?
We were the same set of engineers. I mean, yeah, it was crazy. And maybe Saul will talk more about it. But yeah, we managed it with the same set of resource. The teams remained the same. Yeah, maybe Saul can take on, and then he talk about what other changes we had to do in the organizational level.
Yeah, I think it's hard to. So the interesting thing was that, of course, because this happens overnight, you can't plan for it. So you just take it as it comes. And what I think the critical part, well, it was a number of parts, but first of all, organizationally, you need to detect that you need to do something about it. So our organization decided that this was a good fight worth fighting. Like, helping with our work was something that we could do to have a positive impact in, you know, in the situation at hand. So that meant drop everything else you're doing, and you do this now. And everybody's brain was set to work on this task, right? And you may be working on mobile, you may be working on the web, you may be working on the infrastructure side of things. It doesn't really matter, because everybody has some ideas or has some stuff that you know, that can add in the end. And it was this collective hive mind that helped us remove all the bottlenecks along the way until we could make it scale. And of course, the second part to that is that sometimes you need to throw money at the problem, or in this case, hardware, which you buy with money. So someone needs to open up their wallet and use that, you know, VC money, I guess, and spend it in something good. So in this case, it was paying the AWS bill. And we even had an interesting happenstance there. Like, we tweeted as a joke to the Amazon CTO, is like, hey, can you take this one for us? And suddenly, out of nowhere, Amazon's DevRel gets in touch with us. We have a meeting. They say, we're going to work out a deal with you folks. They wanted to actually publish some guides on helping people deploy Jitsi for their own, you know, for their own organizations. And I collaborated personally with them to write the part for containerizing on AWS. So suddenly, serendipitously, these things happen, right? So it was the same amount of engineers as before. It's just handling 300 times more people. But as Jaya pointed out, we had a solid foundation. So we just needed to iron out some of the kinks, and then we were off to the races. And right now, after all the optimizations that we've done, we can handle, we're handling less of the load as before, but we have like 1/4 of the infrastructure. So, you know, we could, like, it took us a little bit to, of course, optimize all of that down. But as she said, it was totally worth it. And Alva also mentioned that open source burnout is something, and you know, we took turns at being burned out. It was just impossible otherwise. But in the end, it's like these, like this image with these doctors and all the overwhelmingly positive feedback is what gives you fuel to continue for the next day, you know. And in the end, it was until we got it under control, we did whatever it took.
Wow, I was just going to ask if we could have some set of indicators that tell us that things are starting going out of control, but I see that in your case, there was no way to foresee what was coming.
I mean, we tried to prevent some of it, like when you hear in the news, France is, or Italy is closing all the schools on Monday, you know Monday is going to be hell. But the interesting thing on the technical level is that you've never seen those traffic patterns. Like, it's one thing to have, I don't know how many thousands of simultaneous users, that's something. But it's something else to have thousands of simultaneous users all connecting at 9 a.m. at the same time. So that is, it looks similar, but it's not. So, and this is really what it's very hard to think about. We reached unprecedented scale levels for ourselves, but not only us, right? So you saw Netflix cutting on quality, Zoom as well. So it's like, this was a worldwide, everybody's scrambling, trying to, you know, patch up fire. Like, you're like a firefighter trying to put out some fires every day. And I think everybody was on a similar boat. You know, we have a cool story to tell because it's a small open source project that suddenly became somewhat more well known. But I think many more people were in a similar situation, and we are thankful that people recognize their value and we're humbled that we could help.
Great, thanks, Saul. So you mentioned the VC money in that case that indeed helped with the emergency. And speaking about money, I'm switching back to Alva to ask you about the funding, right? Because for any open source project to become sustainable, it also needs to be financially stable. So, and you know that the CDIM, in the CDIM we have what we call a public common partnership, meaning that we have a big public investment behind the project, and we also have our community who manages the project from the very beginning. But in your view, Alba, what other funding sources can a project like the CDIM consider in order to ensure its sustainability beyond the contributions from public institutions?
Well, I don't know if I'm the most suitable person to address this question, because the Foundation for Public Code, we consider ourselves a non-partisan, a non-lobbying organization. So we, let's say that we don't get into business models, if I can put it like that. But we only, for instance, work with we only work with government organizations. But I think, for instance, the CDIM has been doing it very well so far, working with universities, for instance. So you're also diversifying by doing that. Also, I don't know, or even getting contributions from both individuals and organizations. So I think that's a pretty interesting technique. I think Consul also did something similar back in the days. So,
Yeah, I heard about some of these options, no, that we have now, like using maybe GitHub sponsors or something like that. And we will definitely look at these other funding sources next year with our association. So let's talk a little bit also about open source communities and the different governance models that they can adopt. I'm very curious to know how the GT community works, if it's open to everyone. Jaya mentioned also something about it in her presentation. And I was looking around, I saw that you are using Discord as a kind of a community forum. But also in your GitHub repository, I have seen some issues labeled with, for example, with feature requests. So I don't know how this workflow works.
We don't have, I would say, a set of rules, right? We wing it. So first of all, our like Jitsi is open to anyone to participate. You can either file issues, send pull requests, join a forum. And also we have a bi-weekly community call where people can ask questions, you know, request features and whatnot. And we have outside collaborators, but the GT team that is working at 8x8 is, let's say, the part of the team that sets the direction of the project. And this means that even though we do take pull requests, feature requests, they need to fall in the scope of the vision we're trying to fulfill. And that means that sometimes, even though some idea may be a good one, we consider it to be not part of the core project. We are trying to keep the project, so we engineer it so that you can build on top of it, rather than bolt everything to it a little bit. For example, one of the things we haven't mentioned is that, so Jitsi is right now on its sort of third hosting company, if you will. It has started out independently in a company founded by the original founder, Emily Boff, then got acquired by Atlassian, then we got acquired by 8x8. And I don't think there's many projects that have survived two acquisitions and remained equally open source and with a thriving ecosystem. So the thing that allowed us to move from one place to the other so easily is because we designed the APIs, we designed how the whole thing works to plug things in and out instead of tying yourself to the Atlassian infrastructure, to the 8x8 infrastructure, so we can shift pieces around. And this means that being open source friendly is our priority, but at the same time, we need to make sure that we don't end up with feature creep, because in open source, there is no such a thing as free code. It's free as in a free puppy. You need to feed it, take it out, like take care of it. You need to maintain it as well. So that's also one of the motivating factors for creating this Jitsi as a service platform. Like there's people that have, you know, businesses around other areas that want to have a meeting capability. Imagine like telehealth, education, etc. And What we are doing is allowing these people to worry about their problem domain and then inject meetings into their problem domain. We take care of the meetings, we have that expertise, and then they have their expertise and they can combine the two. But the community has certainly a huge impact in what we do in the form of, as Jaya said, we got this overwhelming feedback. I don't know what to do when I'm alone. So we fixed that. And we have even gone back into some stuff we said very loud we were not going to do because we still listen. For example, this view you're watching right now, we call it Brady Bunch mode because it looks like the Brady Bunch starting credits and or Zoom's gallery view, I think they call it. And we really didn't want to do it. But then at one point, we cave in and we did it. And what we've seen during the pandemic is that we haven't seen almost a single screenshot of the other view when people were saying, oh, I'm meeting with all these people. So it was definitely a success in the end. Community wanted it. We finally went for it. And it's not great. And the same goes for using Jitsi on the mobile browser. Because we do have mobile apps which have a better experience, we had said we're not going to try to make it work on the mobile browser because we have a better experience. But turns out that there's many people that just want to do a one-off quick call. And for that, having to download an app, install it, run it, is too big of a bar. And so then we made it work. Actually, Jaya worked a lot on that part. And now it works. And people can use it that way as well. So the input is certainly there. And we take lots of contributions also code-wise. I would say probably the biggest part where we get contributions is translations, because all the internationalization that we have in Jitsi is community contributed.
Yeah, exactly. In the stream, we have the same big part of the contributions come to the translation system. I believe that the stream is available now in almost 50 languages. And this is, of course, thanks to the effort to many contributors around the world that just, I mean, we did the infrastructure to enable this collaboration, but of course, it's the rest of the people to that helps, no, with that work. And I think we are very aligned in this vision on the architecture, let's say Jitsi, but let's say the CDM. We also try to keep our core code base very small because the architecture of the CDM is very modular. So we also try to encourage to go to this model. But you know, sometimes it's a bit delicate to draw the line and where do you accept the new contributions or not, or maybe because of the time that you were telling at the beginning, maybe it's not the right time now, but in 2 months will be. So, okay, so I need to control a little bit the time because we are having such an interesting conversation that we are running a little bit out of time, but let me ask you another question about the communities. Because I mean, when we talk about the open source community, it's important to talk about healthy communities, and this is related to the level of diversity and inclusion and openness that a community has. So, Alba, do you think that in general, open source communities have improved in this subject, in diversity and inclusion, or we are still very far from the desirable scenario?
It's a bit tricky, this question, because yes, the answer is yes, in a sense that I feel that every single community, almost normal ones at least, they are walking towards that goal, that vision, and that's pretty cool. But especially, for instance, in the open source communities, maybe because of the, I don't know, that people can feel a little bit safer, you know, behind the screen. I 100% perceive it way more than in other physical communities that I see that. And also, for instance, from the Foundation for Public Code point of view, the code bases we work with, we also try to include it in our, let's say, recommendations when they start, when they launch one of these code bases, is one of the first things to do, include the code of conduct. It's something that we try to make happen, and not just as a document that, you know, you just place here and you, you know, wash your hands, like, no, everything's fine. But yeah, we also try to pursue that goal for sure.
And what about you, Jaya and Saul? Does Jitsi have any code of conduct or any policy in this regard?
So at the moment, we don't actually. Our community has organically grown since it was very small until right now. And I get this kind of a cop-out, but the reality is we haven't seen, like, not going to say a need, but, you know, it hasn't been, it's like with a feature request, it hasn't been requested off of us. We haven't had instances where we thought it would solve the problem. So it hasn't organically come up. I don't believe anybody would object to it. Like, I participate in many open source communities that have one, very happy to participate if they have one. From where I stand, I understand. I am, of course, part of a small privileged group, but I haven't never been, you know, set aside for not having one. So I think I haven't seen all of it. But, you know, we, so far, the Don't Be a Jerk has worked. I understand that it's a bit too little sometimes, but for some reason or another, in our community, it has worked so far. I know we have some, you know, guidelines, some stuff in our forum, for example, some rules of decorum, and we have had to ban people. This happens. On GitHub, not really, for example. So everything has been a little bit come as you are. And for now, it has worked. Should we do some more? Likely. I think the answer to both of your questions is yes. We're better off than we were, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, in open source. But I think it's the continuous improvement, because everything changes, society changes, life changes. Like right now, we're having this conference, you know, behind the screen, which is, for example, probably a lot less intimidating for many people to interact this way than it is to physically go to a conference and stand in front of the audience and tell a message. So we also need to get with the times, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's also a matter of experimentation, right? Just to experiment what other formulas can work. For example, here in the CDIM, we used to have like what we called MetaDecidIM labs, and they were like academic seminars to do some research on some topic related to DecidIM. And we had one related to the gender perspective, building a platform with a gender perspective. And we found that, for example, our contributor base in GitHub was, we only had like three female contributors from a total of 70 or 80 developers. So we launched an initiative this year to engage more women developers and non-binary gender people to participate, and using some grants system just to allow them to learn the CDIM for a few weeks and interact with the rest of the community. And now I checked yesterday, and we are having more than 15 female developers now participating. So there wasn't a problem, because I think our community is quite friendly. When you compare with others, you realize that yours is really nice people there. But maybe it's just what I was saying, you know, a matter of experimenting and see what do you can achieve. Open the doors.
And if I may, something else here, not only from the foundation point of view, but also like in my previous professional experience, I've seen that in some communities, I'm not saying any of the community is present here do that, but I've seen in the past that some communities, they just adopt like a passive way of approaching this problem, just waiting for these underrepresented collectives to show up. And that's not how it works. You have to actually, you know, establish like a conversation with these groups, understand what's going on and why they are not feeling very enthusiastic about joining. And I don't know, you have to be a little bit more active than, you know, just waiting for them to join.
Exactly. Yeah, we all have homework to do in this topic, I think. So let's go with the last question, because I don't think I have time to, I want to go through the questions from the community, but a very important question, at least for us, and this is more directed to Alba. What do you think, Alba, should be the role of public institutions in supporting and promoting FLOS projects beyond the funding part? And I'm thinking now about the recently launched strategy plan that the European Commission released a few weeks ago, where they say that they want to promote open source software within their organization. Do you think this will make a difference? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I hate being the you know, saying the same thing that I said before, but as per our founding principles, we are a non-profit and non-partisan organization. But, however, we love hearing about new public organizations that have chosen to use open source. And in this case, it's pretty interesting because, first of all, it's interesting to see in that document that the European Commission, they highlight the clear operational benefits that that go in through this path has, right? So you can believe A or B, but you know, at least you have facts here that speak from themselves. So I think that's pretty cool. And yeah, from the foundation point of view, I think we're pretty excited that this new European Commission strategy encourages the European Commission to work more closely with the wider open source community, as well as scaling up their own practice. Let's see.
Yeah, let's see what happens. We are also hopeful that this will have an impact. Okay, they're telling me that we are running now. This is the final warning. We are running a little bit out of time, but I think we have time to answer at least one question from the community. And to the rest that I'm going to check right now, maybe you could answer directly in MetaDecidim if you have time after the call. But let's go with this first one from Oliver Acevedo. He asked to the Jitsi team, I'd be curious to hear about Jitsi's ecosystem to possibly start a conversation comparing it with Decidim's own, and a discussion about the challenges in handling diverse demands from different stakeholders. I think we commented a little bit on that, but if you want to elaborate.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of what I said before. It goes down to a little bit of the governance model or stewardship. So we are kind of the ones that would drive the project forward for the most part, at least set the direction. We have a product team, but also we are very independent. So I don't check with anyone before replying on GitHub, and Jaya doesn't either. Because I think we're a small enough team, and we are more than that, we are actually very like-minded. We have the Jitsi vision of things. So, but when we don't know or when in doubt, we kind of ask around. And that's a little bit how we set the line. But as I said, it doesn't necessarily mean that the line will stay that way, because many things happen, you know. We were like a bit over 2 years ago, we were part of a different organization, and suddenly one day you get called into a meeting and you're told you're leaving. And then something else happens and you find yourself taking a slightly different direction, or suddenly you find yourself fixing, like dropping projects that you were super passionate about to fix your new passion, which is keeping the infrastructure alive. So I think it's important to have some guiding principles, but at the same time, keep yourself nimble and flexible so that whatever happens, you can quickly adapt and overcome. Is if we take a look at Jitsi's past, for example, if they started out as a PhD candidate's project that did multi-protocol messaging on the desktop, right? Then fast forward some years, WebRTC came, and turns out that thanks to that technology, you could bring this part to the browser and suddenly make it available to a much broader audience. So again, the guiding principle was, oh, let's do this, but suddenly, wait a second, this thing disrupts our industry as it did. And it's important to recognize these factors and move forward with them. Piggybacking on one of the last things that Jaya mentioned, end-to-end encryption, we hold the, we're very happy to say that we are the first to implement the end-to-end encryption by using the APIs that Google built into Chrome, like the minute they were available. And why? Well, because people wanted this. They needed this. Some people need this, and some people want this. Someone needs it, and we went for it. And that's what we do. You know, did we have in our roadmap end-to-end encryption? Hell no. But suddenly it becomes feasible, so we jump on it. And that's sort of how we do. We don't have a 10-year master plan on a binder collected past. No, we see, we test, we adapt, we overcome, we maintain, and we keep ourselves light and flexible.
And maybe that's your secret sauce to become successful with a project. I'm afraid we're going to end the call here. It's been really a pleasure to have this conversation with all of you, Alba, Jaya, Saul. We've learned a lot from your experience and your insights, and we hope we can meet someday in person, and not only through this really cool platform. So
yeah, congrats, thanks for having us.
Congrats on everything you are doing, and keep up the great work.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Carol, and thanks for having us.
And thank you to everyone who joined us for this session. We're going to leave it here for today. I hope you all enjoyed all the keynotes and sessions we had in this first day of the Sedin Fest. We're going back tomorrow at 10:30 CET time with an interesting technopolitical panel on participation and research. So don't miss it, and see you there. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Thanks.